have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Well, big week for elections. Did they turn out as you expected?
Oh, speaking of turnout.
Yeah.
It was one of the lowest ever. And, you know, the Elections Commission were predicting, you know, over 50% turnout because of all of the important races. Well, turnout averaged about 34 to 35%. Statewide. And in the most populous counties, we drug the percentage down, because here in King County, it was 33%. In Snohomish, it was the same. And in Pierce, it was about 34%. So really, literally, you have about one third of the voters determining who gets to go to the final in November.
Yeah. And, you know, in the biggest race, that was a good thing. But in a number of other ways, this is problematic. To start with the biggest one first, for most of the past year, Rob McKenna has been ahead of Jay Inslee in the polls. It was really only in the last few days that that Inslee pulled even, and even a little bit ahead. And sure enough, he won by 45,000 votes in the primary, which is particularly good news since, as Maria mentioned, the turnout in Inslee's stronghold of King County and this greater Seattle metro area was somewhat depressed compared to the rest of the state.
Yeah, some of the rural counties had over 50%.
Yeah, so Inslee with 46.78%, McKenna with 43.28%, at least with about 100,000 votes still to count, and the minor candidates on both the Republican and the Democratic sides and independents being pretty much a wash. So at this point, McKenna has some ground to pick up. Now, it's still fairly close, and there's going to be a ton of national money coming into this race, because it's one of the closest and most competitive governor's races in the country this year. That being, and of course, the first really strong or one of the only really strong chances that the Republicans have had to pick up the governor's mansion in 20 years in the state of Washington. So we're going to see more on this race a lot, but it's encouraging that that Inslee is starting from a position of strength in the primary.
All right.
The rest of the news, unfortunately, wasn't nearly as good. And talking about the influence of money in politics, we saw the redistricting of the federal congressional districts this year were being designed to protect incumbents, and they worked exactly as designed. There were no, even in District 6, which is where Norm Dix is retiring, and that's becoming an open seat, the new district, District number 10 outside Olympia, the 3rd district, which used to be a swing district in southwest Washington, Reichert's district, the 8th on the east side, which used to be a swing district, all of them solidly going for the incumbent, or in the case of District 6, the Democrat who's running to replace Norm Dix, all won very comfortably. The only really competitive district, it looks like, is the 1st district, where the one Republican running, John Koster, won easily and will go to the final. Several Democrats were running to become the second candidate in that race, and Susan DelBene, who is the Microsoft millionaire favored by centrist establishment Democrats like Christine Gregoire and Rick Larson, had been tied in the polls up until the final week with Darcy Berner, the more progressive challenger. DelBene, though, a millionaire on her own right, and then with a lot of corporate money on her own behalf, flooded the TV with ads in the last week or two, and she pulled away and won very comfortably.
A real
testimony to the influence of money in these kind of races.
She really proved how money can buy you an election, and it only takes a couple weeks.
Yep. And then also somewhat disturbing were some of the judicial races and making really pretty strong cases for why judicial races shouldn't be elections. Because most people don't know anything about the actual races. The Washington State Supreme Court races in particular, in position 8, we had Steve Gonzalez, who was the incumbent, who was endorsed by every other sitting Supreme Court justice, running against an incredibly unqualified nut job from Kitsap County named Bruce Danielson, who
didn't really campaign, did he?
He campaigned, but he campaigned basically the same way he's campaigned in Kitsap County for various fringe campaigns over the years, which is that he's a right, far right bigot.
Yeah,
But he was running against a Hispanic, and therefore he still managed, even though Gonzalez spent a lot of money, he still managed to get 40% of the vote. And east of the Cascades, he got over 60% of the vote in every single county except Benton. He won all of the counties, and in Adams and Douglas, he was over 70%. You know, if Gonzalez had not been able to raise and spend a lot of money in that race, we could have a seriously deranged guy on the Washington State Supreme Court just by virtue of the fact that he's white, a white guy running against a Latino. Very, very frightening that he did that well.
So you're saying we don't live in a post-racist society?
Well, and oddly enough, that was reinforced by the other Supreme Court race in position number 9, where we had Richard Sanders, who, as people may remember, was on the Washington State Supreme Court until a big kerfuffle a couple of years ago when he got caught making some racist statements, which he had a history of earlier in his career as well. Now, he's not nearly as much of a bigot or a nut job as Danielson is, but it was still enough to make sure that he did not win re-election 2 years ago. He made the runoff in Washington State Supreme Court number 9, so he will be on the ballot in November.
Well, the returns are still coming in, and it's really close in that race, but he could very well make it as of last night,
he's ahead by a couple thousand votes. So.
Yeah, but there's still about 115,000 to count, so yeah. It could still swing to Bruce Hillier. That race is very, very close. Cheryl Gordon McLeod has 29%, Sanders has 28%, and Hillier has 27%. So, and as you said, you know, it's a couple thousand votes that separates each of those three, so he could still get bumped. But yeah, you're right.
The fact that he did so well.
That he did so well, yeah, is disturbing.
And then a local race that we had here that we talked about a couple of weeks ago, King County Superior Court number 42, where the incumbent, Chris Washington, rated out of the Superior Court justice number 50 out of 50 in every single category by the King County Bar Association. Truly dreadful judge by just about every measure of his peers. He made the final also at a four-way race, and he made it against the conservative opponent, Sue Parisian, a former aide to Rob McKenna. So we've got a very, very disturbing choice there. One of those two is going to become a Superior Court judge in King County, and by any measure, it ought to be Sue Parisian, because even though she's an ideologue, at least she is, you know, qualified to be a judge.
Yeah.
So again, more testimony to why do we elect judges again? Because most people are not familiar with their records or who these people are. They're just going on name familiarity, the apparent gender or ethnicity of the name, or whether they recognize the name from lawn signs.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Other developments from the election?
No, I think that's good. Let's move on.
All right. Let's then that takes us.
Oh, I did want to talk a little bit about the propositions. The fact that the juvenile jail squeaked through and the library levy passed 63% approval. And that's kind of interesting because, you know, we're going to have a lot of fiscal things on the ballot come November. And there's been a lot of talk about will voters vote to raise taxes on themselves during an economic downturn. And it looks like so far, at least people in the city of Seattle or in the greater King County region don't seem to have a problem with that. So that's kind of interesting thing to see for November.
Sure.
Although we'll see if that continues as we get closer and closer to the fiscal cliff.
the local fiscal cliff or the national?
No, the
all
national,
of the above.
The national fiscal cliff.
Yes.
You know what I'm talking about, right? The fact that the federal government doesn't have a real budget plan in place, which means those mandatory cuts that were voted in by the last congressional session will have to go through.
Yeah, and there's a real showdown looming in Congress with Republicans who are refusing to compromise on that.
Yes, and the fact that most of the Bush era tax cuts are set to expire by the end of the year unless Congress passes a tax plan.
Moving on to national, but wait, Doesn't the new VP nominee
have a plan?
Oh, yeah, he's got a plan. Let's talk about Paul Ryan's
plan, shall
we?
He's got a plan not to really have a plan.
Yeah.
Oh, he's terrible, yeah.
Yeah, so...
So Mitt Romney's announcement for vice president is Paul Ryan.
Yes, who's the congressman from Wisconsin who has basically made a national name for himself over the last several years. He first came to prominence as the advocate who convinced George Bush in 2005 that it'd be a great idea to privatize Social Security. And he's been selling that snake oil ever since and has managed by virtue of stroking his chin a lot, basically, to convince most elite political media in this country that he is a serious thinker, even though none of his budget proposals and so-called alternative budgets add up at all. At all. This is a man who, if his budget proposals are to be taken seriously, will literally eviscerate most functions other than the military and tax cuts and credits very wealthy.
His plan would actually also eviscerate the military. I mean, these budget proposals that he's been introducing and that unfortunately the House keeps passing as they did in 2011 and earlier this year.
The primary target's the middle class, though.
Yeah, is really our plans that would not just eviscerate government, but pretty much bankrupt the country. He wants to reduce all income tax rates, eliminate all taxes on capital gains and other investment income.
No corporate income tax.
Dividends and interest, no corporate income tax, no estate taxes, no AMT, the alternative minimum tax, which is supposed to make rich people pay their fair share. He wants to privatize, as Jobs said, privatize Social Security and Medicare. It's just... And then the cuts that he lists are
completely unrealistic, there's no way to do it without eliminating just about all of the middle class tax breaks that exist, including child credits and mortgage deduction. I mean, you name it.
And then he wants to add back a value added tax, a VAT tax of like 8.5%, and that's it's based on consumption, but it's a little bit like a sales tax. In other words, meaning that it would shift the tax burden down the income ladder to the people at on the very bottom rungs.
Now, the interesting thing about this is that Ryan's math does not add up, but he has consistently not been called by national media on the fact that his math does not add up. And, presumably this is going to become a major focus of the presidential campaign from here on out, because Romney has been very vague so far on his economic plan. The Democrats had been polling earlier this year and doing focus groups on whether to make the Ryan budget proposals, which have been signed off on by every Republican in Congress, whether to make those the centerpiece of a presidential campaign. And what they found out was, no, we don't want to spend a lot of time criticizing these in ads because people don't believe that it could actually be true. They cannot imagine that something that radical could seriously be proposed by a major
candidate.
By a major candidate and a major political party,
pass one House of Congress.
And pass one House of Congress, proposed by a junior representative from Wisconsin that nobody had heard of, who was basically an Ayn Rand fanboy. Mm-hmm. Now, this is going to become a central part of the campaign, whether Democrats want it to or not. And what you have to remember about this is, yeah, the numbers don't add up, but the crises, quote unquote, with Social Security and Medicare, those numbers have not added up for the decade now that Wall Street's been trying to get its fangs into that pot of money. And yet, with the amount of disinformation that's gone out, most people are still not aware that those numbers don't add up. So don't assume that just because the numbers don't figure and just because the consequences would be catastrophic, that that they're not going to be able to get away with this. It's a very real possibility.
One of the things that I find interesting about Romney appointing Ryan as his VP candidate is that it really shows that Romney has no clue that he's just made, I think, a major mistake, like McCain did when he chose Sarah Palin, because Ryan has a record, and that record in the House is what the Obama administration is going to focus on, and they're going
to go
attack
to town.
And they're going to, you know, be running ads saying, you know, this man wanted to get rid of Social Security. This man wanted to get rid of Medicare. Is this the man you want for Vice President of the United States? And Romney's going to sit there and he's going to say, why can't we talk about the issues and not about
past? What Romney is going to do is, or Romney's surrogates are going to do, they are going to take a boatload of money that they're going to get from the PACs, and they're going to lie through their teeth, which is what they've been doing for the last year and a half. And they're just going to try and make so much noise and throw out, you know, so many ridiculous claims that it all gets lost in the white noise.
Because what else can they do?
I mean, they
have two very terrible candidates that they're trying to sell. And
so, so basically, the task at this point, because truly, Romney and Ryan in positions of power, and if they win, it almost certainly would mean as well that Republicans would control both houses of Congress. And, you know, we all know what a bang-up job the Democrats did during the Bush administration in stiffly opposing radical Republican policies. You know, as flawed as Obama has been, you know, Ryan and Romney in positions of power would be catastrophic beyond belief. So, you know, whether or not you wind up voting for Obama, I think, you know, a lot of us need to be talking to our friends and neighbors about remedial math skills. And just saying, you know, this stuff does not add up, and here's what it would really mean. And yes, they really are serious. It is a massive wealth transfer scheme from everybody else to the very, 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 very wealthy. And that's their idea of public policy. Mm-hmm. And that's what this presidential campaign is going to be about.
Woohoo. All right. Let's move on. Talk about WikiLeaks and Trapwire.
Yeah, WikiLeaks has been the target of a huge number of denial of service attacks. It's because this week they put up they've been putting up emails relating to Trapwire. What is Trapwire? Well, it is a nationwide surveillance system created by a company called Abraxas, based in Northern Virginia, which is a company that's staffed by former CIA, Pentagon, NSA, and other employees of federal intelligence agencies.
And very closely connected to them.
Yes, and you know, the fact that it's based in Northern Virginia is a clue that it's still very closely connected to U.S. intelligence agencies. It collects data from surveillance cameras all over the U.S., so if you're used to seeing those big traffic cameras or cameras in public places, that's the data that's going into this huge central database. Now, they mine this data. They sift through it with facial recognition software and other types of software, looking at, say, for example, the license plate number of your vehicle. And they can shoot that data back out to police departments all over the United States. And, of course, there is no warrant required for any of this. So that's a bit of a scandal.
And it's in private hands.
Yeah, it's a scandal. And it's in private hands, and it's not being picked up at all by the national media. It's WikiLeaks, once again, who got a hold of some hacked emails that is posting this online. And that's a scandal, too, the fact that this has been going on and we have not heard a thing about it.
Yeah, so here we have WikiLeaks practicing actual journalism and supposed journalists not even bothering to cover it when somebody else practices journalism, let alone doing it themselves.
And my understanding is a lot of the stuff they're looking for is supposedly they're looking for terrorists, and the idea being that they're trying to catch these terrorists before they do something.
Yes.
So they're looking for people
Didn't
who are
Spielberg
photographing.
Make a movie about that?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
What's it called? Minority Report.
Yes, exactly.
Yes, and
so they're looking for pre-crime.
And literally, yes, minority.
And yes, and suspicious looking people, which brings up the issue of racial profiling too.
Yeah.
But again, not looking for people that are necessarily actually committing crimes. They're looking for people that are doing things that they believe will eventually lead to committing a crime, and then
yes.
that they're
having brown skin, for example.
Whatever their criteria is, which we don't know because it's highly secret.
Yes, but having brown skin is probably one of them.
All right, so something that people need to keep track of here.
Yes.
Let's move on.
Okay.
Speaking of racism and racial profiling, there was a lot in the news this week around that. The killings in Milwaukee suburban Milwaukee on Sunday at a Sikh temple. The guy who is arrested in that case has a background as a white supremacist, spent 6 years in the 90s in the military, including being stationed at Fort Bragg doing PSYOP, psychological operations. And it was very interesting that even though the community support in the greater Milwaukee area has been tremendous, there was a huge memorial service yesterday attended by thousands of people, it really wasn't nearly as large a national story as the massacre a couple weeks previously in Colorado. And even though in this case it was clearly a hate crime, it was clearly racially motivated, whether it was generically racially motivated or whether the guy thought that the Sikhs are actually Muslim, it was not clear. But there were a couple of other major stories this week that did involve Muslims. One, the burning to the ground of a mosque in Joplin, Missouri on Monday. And then, the estimate was that it would cost $250,000 to replace. That money within 24 hours midweek had been raised on the internet. And it's over 300,000 now, which is great to see. And then a mosque in Murfreesboro, Tennessee that's been the target of repeated attacks as well as political attacks, over the past couple of years, in Tennessee, managed to have its opening finally. So those kind of stories have been very much in the news this week, but they didn't get nearly as much attention as the theater shooting in Colorado did.
Yeah, so the national mainstream media, they love a crazy young guy, but they can't get their arms around a white racist supremacist doing domestic terrorism.
Yeah, although I think there's at least one other significant factor there, which is really only indirectly racist, which is that in terms of the audience, almost everybody in this country can imagine themselves at a theater. Very few people in this country can imagine themselves at a Sikh temple, or would put themselves in imagining that situation. And, you know, why people would distinguish that as opposed to just generally being at a house of worship, which is something that most people are familiar with, is another question. But again, it didn't get nearly the media attention, and that shows that we do not, contrary to what I think Maria said earlier, we do not now live in a colorblind society. Yeah. Mm. Not quite yet.
Not quite yet.
All right. Let's talk about this week's economic news, starting with record profits for banks.
Yeah, the New York Times reported on Thursday that banks are making record profits on mortgages this year. Interest rates for consumers are at record lows at about 3.55% for 30-year mortgages. That's the national average. But, you know, banks are getting that money for almost nothing. Their profit margins in the past have usually been, their spread has usually been 0.5%. That's their profit that they take on the interest that they loan the money out at versus the interest rate at which they pay for getting that money. Currently, their interest rate spread is 1.26%. So they've not only doubled their profit, they've actually quintupled it. So banks, for example, like Wells Fargo, which did about 31%, that's almost a third of all mortgages so far this year, they've made $4.8 billion just in the first 6 months of 2012. And the rates, so that means, of course, that rates, mortgage interest rates should be even lower than they actually are. If banks were content to take the profit that they historically have taken, then the rate that you should be paying to get a mortgage should be about just a little tiny bit above 3% for a 30-year mortgage. That could save a homeowner $30,000 in interest over the life of a $300,000 loan. That's a significant amount of money. And so it also raises the issue of, okay, since it's mainly four big banks now that make mortgage loans, Wells Fargo, JP Morgan Chase, Bank of America, and U.S. Bank Corp. Is there some collusion going on? In other words, price fixing. Are these guys keeping the interest rates artificially high? Well, I think you'd be hard pressed to argue that they're not doing that. And there just isn't any mechanism for making them lower the rates because regulators are not going to do anything.
And you'd also be hard pressed to identify a reason why they wouldn't collude because they're certainly not bound by any moral strictures.
Who's going to punish them?
Exactly, who's going to punish them?
Mm-hmm. All right. Also related, a study out this week about corporate income tax rates.
Yeah, the financial site NerdWallet having a study of America's 10 most profitable corporations, those including Wells Fargo and JP Morgan Chase, as well as ExxonMobil, Chevron, Apple, Microsoft, IBM, AT&T, Verizon, and GE. Corporate citizens, all of them, they paid an average corporate income tax rate in 2011 of exactly 9%.
So why exactly are we encouraging these guys to make so much money if we're not getting much return on it as citizens who rely on the infrastructure that taxpayer dollars fund?
And interestingly enough, the lower
just 'cause it creates jobs?
the lowest rates go to those companies that get the biggest subsidies from the federal government, namely the oil companies, ExxonMobil and Chevron. ExxonMobil paid $1.5 billion on 73.3 billion dollars in earnings. That is an effective tax rate of 2%. Chevron was just behind them at 4%.
All right. Also this week, July, just came out in July, hottest month
on
record.
Yes, the hottest month ever on record since 1895, even hotter than July 1936, which was at the height of the Dust Bowl. Currently, 63% of the nation is experiencing a drought, and meteorologists say nothing really will be able to break this cycle unless we have a huge El Nino pattern that develops, or we have an enormous hurricane that moves up from the Gulf of Mexico, and of course, that would not be good for anyone. And clearly, it seems now that this is all a big part of climate change. A report in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences this week said that the amount of the world covered by extreme heat in summer has soared from less than 1%. Prior to 1980, the average used to be 0.2%, up to about 4 to 13% in recent years. The lead author, James Hansen, is a NASA climate scientist. He said that this could not have happened without human-induced global warming.
Yeah, in fact, one of the quotes, the odds that natural variability created these extremes are minuscule, vanishingly small. To count on those odds would be like quitting your job and playing the lottery every morning to pay the bills.
All right. Just a couple minutes left. Also this week, the Y-12 plant in Oak Ridge had a couple visitors.
Yeah, Transform Now Plowshares action in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. Sister Megan Rice, age 82. Also Michael Wally, 63. And Jonah House stalwart Greg Borti Obed, 57, used bolt cutters and got into the highest security area where nuclear warheads are worked on and the nation's primary supply of bomb-grade uranium is housed. This being something of an embarrassment to the DOE and the Obama administration, the head of Oak Ridge Security has been fired, and the Oak Ridge nuclear facilities stood down for at least a week. This got extensive media coverage. A little bit of the media coverage even wandered on toward the question of what on earth are we doing maintaining these expensive and pointless and incredibly dangerous weapons in the first place, which of course was the point of the protest.
Yeah. Thank you to those ninja nuns.
Absolutely. They are remarkably courageous, remarkably dedicated, and deserve all of our support.
All right. Just about a minute left. Can you touch on the
Gauss virus?
Yes.
A fourth U.S. cyber warfare attack this week. This time against Lebanese banks. 2,500 computers at selected Lebanese banks were infected with the Gauss virus, which was made by the same group that wrote the Flame virus. That was the data mining virus and surveillance virus that was discovered earlier this year. Flame is linked to Stuxnet, which disabled Iran's nuclear centrifuges because an early version of Stuxnet used a module from the Flame virus. The New York Times has reported and written that the U.S. and Israel wrote and deployed Stuxnet, so it seems very clear that not only did the U.S. Deploy the Flame virus, but also deployed the Gauss virus, and this makes a lot of sense because these Lebanese banks that were targeted are known for doing business with the Syrian government, handling their finances, and also handling the finances of Hezbollah, which is on the U.S. Terrorism list.
Yeah, and two quick things on that. One, this is an act of war, and second, that these cyber attacks very much encourage other countries to engage in a cyber arms race and develop these technologies. Very, very dangerous precedents.
Yes.
All right. Events? I believe I'm the only one with an event.
Yes, you're the only one with an event this week.
There, as those
don't get nervous.
As those of you that tuned in from 7:30 to 8, the Fair Trade Music effort is having a meeting this coming Monday. It's a grassroots campaign to build a more sustainable music scene in Seattle and the Pacific Northwest, and that's happening Monday, 7 p.m. at the Labor Temple, which is 2800 First Avenue. Will be in Hall 1. So musicians who play clubs, DJs, whoever, you're all invited to attend. Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
www.eatthestate.org.
And you can find my articles at mariatomczyk.com. And I'm also updating a blog, mariatomczyk.blogspot.com.